Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books here on 90.7 KPFK-FM. On today's show, one of our favorite LARB contributors, Boris Draliuk, stops by to tell us about Los Angeles poet Henri Coulette. Jerry Stahl is back, this time to talk about the Flannery O'Connor short story, Good Country People. You might want to stick around because someone gets their wooden leg stolen. Author Nina Revor stops by to recommend a book by Angela Flournoy called The Turner House. There's an author our friend John Powers is going to tell us about. He is from Pittsburgh by way of El Salvador, and that's the author who John's going to tell us about, not John himself. And that author's name is Horacio Castellanos Moya. Joining me are my usual co-conspirators, Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. And be sure to keep listening because toward the end of the broadcast, BJ Novak is finally going to be on. We've bumped him, I believe, 7 times now. I've actually lost count. And once again, he has kindly consented to come back and talk about his new book and maybe a few other things. So make sure you stay tuned for that. A few weeks ago, we talked to Boris Draliuk. He's a professor at St. Andrews University in Scotland, but he actually grew up in Los Angeles and is an authority on the literature of this city. He talked to us about the poet Henri Coulette and read one of his poems as well.
Well, it's interesting because as soon as you left L.A. and you moved to Scotland...
I know, Hank's bar closed. Tiki Tico's for 2 weeks.
The whole place is,
falling apart.
Yeah. We blame that on you.
Yeah.
No, I brought it up because you started writing essays, which is a classic expat thing to do, right?
It is.
Started writing essays about your lost hometown.
Right? Absolutely.
And one of them was about a poet named Henri Coulette.
Yes.
Coulette, sorry.
Henri Coulette. But of course, his name was Henri Coulette.
Henri Coulette.
Yeah. Spelled
of course,
Henri.
It's Henri. Henri Coulette.
The pretensions of his mother. Henri.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Are you saying he's not Tom's French?
He's not French.
He's not as pretentious
Black
as me.
Irish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a part of the story, of course, is this pretensions of stage mothers.
And
yeah,
so
Los Angeles mothers.
So tell us about Henri Coulette.
Sure. Coulette is a poet I discovered in the first years of my college education. I was very hungry for poetry, and as usual, very hungry for poetry that would be close to home. I'm always looking for things that are close to home. And by a circuitous route, I discovered Coulette, the first poet I discovered that really spoke to me, by contemporary, of course, I mean mid-20th century and on. A poet that really spoke to me was Weldon Keyes. I accidentally ran across some poems by Weldon Keyes that were much closer to my mood than anything I had read by Americans previously, an angsty young man's mood, a depressive mood. And this poet I discovered after having submitted some poems to a journal at a very young age. They were accepted for the journal, and suddenly I see Weldon Keyes, his image on the masthead, and that image drew me immediately, before the poems did. I looked up who this fellow was and found that the poem spoke to me. And
it strikes me, you kind of wear a Weldon Keyes mustache.
I do, yeah.
Is that in honor of Weldon Keyes?
It's actually his mustache.
Yeah. You
it's amazing.
No, it's, yeah, things you find on eBay. It's incredible. Yeah. The mustache is the latest incarnation of a series of botched facial hair.
That's your next book.
Arrangements. So Keyes led me to Donald Justice, who was an American poet that then began to speak to me more than Weldon Keyes himself, who had edited Keyes's Collected. And then Justice led me to Coulette, a friend of his, who's collected, he also edited, after Coulette passed away in 1988. Now, I came to Los Angeles in 91. He was a poet who was a native Angeleno who passed away in 88. But suddenly, in this volume of collected poems, I saw my Los Angeles, some elements of my Los Angeles, language that I hadn't seen before on the page. And I was rapt. I finally found my idiom reflected, or some part of my idiom reflected in a contemporary voice, in a contemporary American poet. And so Coulette had become a kind of cause of mine. He's not a particularly well-known poet. He's a poet's poet, if that. The man had a run of bad luck. His first book won a major prize. It was very well regarded, but it was published right in the midst of the revolution in American poetry. So this kind of formal, restrained, syllabic verse did not play well when stacked up or stacked next to Howell. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
And so he was immediately overshadowed by a revolution in American poetry. He became rather bitter about this, of course, understandably. He shaped a second collection a few years later, which was by an accident of the publisher pulped in the warehouse before it was distributed.
Oh, my God.
That's bad luck.
That's bad luck.
Yeah.
I think he took to drink a bit. He became...
I've never heard of a poet doing that.
Taking to drink?
No, never.
No, mm-mm. No.
Very
no.
unusual.
No, what time is it, by the way?
I do want to ask one more thing about Coulette, which is he was studied at Cal State LA.
That's right.
Right. And there's a kind of Cal State LA literary history
there very much
waiting
is.
To be written, right?
I mean, oh,
nobody talks about it as far as I know.
There's a very good book, an anthology, contextualized anthology called Poets of the Non-Existent City, which actually features some of Coulette's very early work when he was still a student at Cal State LA. The poet at the hub of this community, the small community that formed in the 1950s in Cal State LA, was Thomas McGrath, mm-hmm. Who's a transplant, not a native Angeleno, but left a staggeringly large mark on Los Angeles poetic history. There was a group of poets that gathered around him that were really first-rate poets and were leaders of the LA poetry revival in the early 1960s. A number of them moved on to other cities, but maintained roots in this community. So Coulette was a part of that. Then he went away to Iowa City when Iowa City was somewhere to be, to the Writer's Workshop, where he was a part of the first really significant class of poets to emerge from Iowa City. This was a group that was studying under Berryman and Lowell. You had mm-hmm. In that group Philip Levine, who was Coulette's best friend for many years, Donald Justice, a very, very significant crop of poets. And then he returned to Cal State LA and really took over the role of mentor at Cal State LA for young poets. And for a formal poet, a white man who was, his most casual attire was a turtleneck. It never went more casual than that, as far as I understand. It was a suit and tie guy who wore a turtleneck mm-hmm. on really, really lousy days.
Yeah? To go bowling.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. to go bowling. Now, for a fellow like that, you would think that he would prefer formal poetry among his students. He would push them in ways that may not be natural to them. But this is a man who fostered Wanda Coleman, a man who fostered Luis Omar Salinas, who sent many young Latino poets up north to Fresno, where they could study with Phil Levine. So it was a very interesting legacy that he left behind that one wouldn't guess that he had the kind of impact that he had on LA poetry, but he certainly did.
And also a friend of Isherwood's.
And a friend of Isherwood, an acquaintance, a friend, mm-hmm. yes, yeah. Isherwood liked him quite a bit, but I don't think they were very close, but he did like him quite a bit.
Can I ask you to do one thing, which is, can you read The Academic Poet for
Absolutely.
Us? Now, one of the things that strikes me about The Academic Poet is that if you relineated it,
yes,
and just made like three or four or five of those lines into one long line,
yes.
it would sound a lot more like Ginsberg than it does.
Oh, without a doubt. Well, the thing about this poem... Well, you know, actually, let me begin by saying this. It's syllabic verse. It looks extraordinarily casual, and that's an effect. That's an effect of great craft and style. So there was a wonderful line, a wonderful epigram by Coulette on Ginsberg, which appears in his collected, that I think says it all, as a good epigram ought. 1,600 lines, give or take 16, and no two lines that you can read between. It's nice, huh?
Yeah, very yeah, nice, yeah. I don't think it's entirely fair.
It's not entirely fair. It's not entirely okay. fair, yeah.
That's
yeah.
okay, that's...
But that's poets.
Epigrams
we fight.
Don't have to
yeah,
be
Yeah, they
fair.
Don't have to be fair, exactly, yeah. exactly. It's a lance. So I'll read to you a poem called The Academic Poet. It tells you a great deal about how Coulette felt, the isolation, being a formal poet in an environment that's not entirely conducive to that kind of poetry, that doesn't reward the craft that he had spent a lifetime acquiring. My office partner dozes at his desk, whimpering now as he dreams of suicide. The November light kisses the scar of his last attempt. I open my mail, a plea for the starving Indian children of North Dakota, a special offer from time, life, and fortune. a letter from a 65-year-old former student suggesting a gland transplant that will make a man of me. It hurts him to hear what they are saying about me behind my back. It hurts me to hear what they are saying to my face pal. I circle two misspelled words and write, "Help, I'm being held hostage at Mickey Mouse State College," across the top, wondering, is this the one, or the fat woman, perhaps, with the postmenopause craze for strict forms? The Sistina, can you use any six words? Well, yes, but they should define a circle, which is the shape I describe, chasing my tail from class to class, the straight line disguised degree by degree.
We're going to take a break right
now. Does
anyone
have any Xanax?
We'll kill ourselves.
Fantastic. Thanks for doing that.
That was Boris Dralyuk schooling us on Henri Coulette. Boris, thanks for coming back to the LARB Radio Hour. This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM. Jerry Stahl, the author of OG Dad, Weird Shit Happens When You Don't Die Young, has been gracious enough to join us again to tell us about an author whose work he really responds to. Welcome, Jerry.
Thanks. The author I was thinking of is the great late Flannery O'Connor, and this collection I really love is called Everything That Rises Must Converge. I read it when I was a kid, just starting to write. And there's one story called Good Country People. And the scene that blew the top of my brain pan off was where this poor girl, Hulga, who has been kind of snookered by a Bible salesman, and she ends up in a hayloft, and she has a wooden leg, I should mention, which the Bible salesman proceeds to toss off the hayloft so that she is stuck up there. And I'm probably not doing the scene justice, but it's so dark and so twisted that I remember as, like, I don't know, I might have been 14 or 15 thinking, I can't even believe you're allowed to write this shit. You know, I had read that, and Nathaniel West, who in one of his books said, written while sniffing the forefinger of my left hand. And that, and the Flannery O'Connor scene with the wooden leg flying off, leaving this poor, sad, vulnerable girl named beautifully Hulga. it both scarred and shaped me as a writer for life. And I can't recommend Flannery O'Connor enough. She was a woman who said, when interviewed about her Catholicism, "Why are you a Catholic?" She answered, "Because Catholics can still recognize the grotesque."
And she is so funny.
Hysterically funny.
Right?
Hysterically funny.
Wise Blood is I think, the greatest American comic novel.
I couldn't agree more.
The writers of The Sopranos must have read that Flannery O'Connor book, because remember when he has an affair with a Russian woman who has a false leg and someone steals her leg?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't remember who or why, but...
I think The Sopranos could not... The Sopranos couldn't have existed really without Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah, I wrote a letter of protest when I saw
that. She's all over that show. Yeah.
She should have footnoted her.
I this is the first time I've heard that theory. I think it's a good theory. I like it.
That scene you describe in the hayloft is, I think, the answer that you give someone when they say, "Tell me about Flannery O'Connor."
Yeah.
You say she's the woman who wrote a scene where a traveling salesman had sex with a girl and stole her wooden leg.
And you might add a Bible salesman.
A Bible salesman.
That's right. Just Bible salesman. Puts it all together.
How could I miss that detail?
Thanks, Jerry, for coming in.
Thank you, man. It's been great. Really appreciate it.
Nina Revor, the author of the new novel Lost Canyon, has been kind enough to come in and visit us once again to tell us about two new books she's been reading. Nina, what are they?
Well, I've been reading Angela Flournoy's book, The Turner House, which follows several generations of an African-American family in Detroit, and the house that is both their legacy and their challenge. And Also, I've been reading The Star Side of Bird Hill by Naomi Jackson, who is a young writer from Barbados, whose short story I selected for a chapbook series several years ago for Bloom, and was so excited to see that she now has a full-length novel out.
Well, tell us about the short story.
The original story that I chose was about a young girl and a family that was based in Barbados and then came to Brooklyn. And some of the complications of history, of secrets, of intergenerational relationships, and also about immigration and how people still consider a place home or don't after they've left it and gone someplace else.
I think it's really interesting what's happening in the immigrant novel these days. I'm thinking of No Violet Bulawayo's We Need New Names. There's a new generation of immigration novels that are, Juno Diaz, for instance, that are just going about the business in a different way.
Yes, I think that's right. There's a different kind of vibrancy. There's less politeness in a way, that people are willing to really tackle, issues that have been not touched before, that have been taboo, and I think are willing also to take on issues such as race and class with a little bit more directness. And so it is making things, just shaking things up a little bit in an interesting way.
And assimilation is not the desire so much as it is something that kind of happens to you, whether you like it or not, and has both positive and negative effects. It's always had positive and negative effects from Abraham Kahan on, but it's not that the immigrant it comes here and wants to change and become an American. It's that the immigrant comes here and is changed by the experience and is watching that change with some dread as well as pleasure.
Yeah, and I think that even broader than immigration, it's the question of where does someone who is other, whether they're an immigrant or a person of color or somehow in another way outside of the mainstream, what is your relationship to this country and to yourself and to your heritage? What do you give up by assimilating or integrating? What do you leave behind? Is there a way that you can hold on to both, that you can hold on to the history, to the past, to your heritage, while also still participating in the larger culture that doesn't make you, in a way that doesn't make you feel like you're compromising?
Nina Rivora, your novel is Lost Canyon. Thanks for coming back to talk to us about what you've been reading.
Thank you for having me.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM. Friend John Powers is back for another visit to the LARB studio. John, we would like you to comment on Horacio Castellanos Moya.
Well, he's one of those writers that maybe you've barely heard of. He was born in Honduras, but raised in El Salvador. He now lives I believe in Pittsburgh. He writes short novels that are steeped in Central American history. He just has a new one out called The Dream of My Return, which is about an intellectual guy trying to decide whether or not to go back to El Salvador. And rather than it being an earnest thing, it's about him, chasing women and trying to do all the stuff he can, partly to go back because he thinks he should go back, because that's where his history is. But then partly it's kind of scary to go back. And what if he goes back? And then he's kind of happy with his life, even though he's alienated from his life. And it's a very slim, elegant little book about what it's like to be an exile in a place that was once really nasty and that you had to flee. Okay. That's the new one. And a lot of people think that's the best one. I think the one that I think is the best was an early one called Senselessness, which is about a guy who's basically his job is to be vetting a report on human rights abuses. And he knows that his job is essentially to clean things up. And it's basically about his relationship to his work and what happens to you when you actually read the reports of what's happening, when you know that nobody quite wants you to actually say that, and that there might even be rational reasons to not say it, because maybe you make the world worse sometimes if you actually express every horrible thing that happened. And it's basically small, compact, and neurotic. Those two books are the are the good ones. And then he's written a couple of funny ones, one basically in which a bunch of snakes get loose in a city and kill people.
So they get on a plane at any point?
They don't get on a plane, but they get in taxis, they get in cars, they're killing people. What I love about him, and this is personal rather than anything he did, which was I'd never heard of him, and somehow I was in London and saw a book called Senselessness and just bought it, not knowing a single thing about him.
Huh.
And read it, and I had that happy feeling we all have, which is like, here's somebody I've never heard of who's really, really, really good.
Yeah.
So I have a special fondness for him. So I read each new book as it comes out. And he's a good writer. You know, I think I probably got suckered in the first time. Or, I mean, I shouldn't sound like I discovered him. You know, I'm sure there's a quote from Roberto Bolaño on the back because I was in a Bolaño phase. I was trusting him on everybody. You know, that was before mm-hmm. I stopped trusting him on everybody. but he's actually, you know, sharp and elegant and pithy.
Now he's writing in Spanish and being translated. He's been living in the U.S.
Yes, but he's only lived in the U.S. for a few years. You know, he was born in Honduras, was raised in El Salvador, then went off to Canada, then bounced back to various other Central American places, started a newspaper in El Salvador, had then moved to Mexico City, has worked as a journalist, and he's now in Pittsburgh. He's kind of been all over the place, which I think probably one of those classic emigre biographies where you're both linked to your home, trying to find some way to be connected to it, but also trying to find some way of living. And probably that's one reason maybe why he's in Pittsburgh now, is that you can survive doing what he does. Whereas probably survival with a politically minded or even culturally minded publication in Central America, you know, but there's both economic and personal survival.
And in El Salvador,
yes.
Tough.
Yeah, he seems to be involved in some sort of amnesty program in Pittsburgh, is what I believe. He's a very good writer, writing about a kind of place that we essentially have forgotten about. You know, one of the weird imperial things about America is you go to places and then you leave and you never pay any attention to what happens. I mean, have you thought about Nicaragua lately? Probably not. You know, we sent soldiers there. Do we care what happens to them afterwards? And then when people write about it, in his case, he's writing about the feelings of people who were living on after the war, which is also less interesting to us. We might be interested in El Salvador, a novel, if in fact it was about them having a civil war that we're involved in. You know, but if it's just them writing about their own lives, we've moved on. You know, there are lots of other miserable places where we're involved. You know, let's read about soldiers in Iraq.
What is the gateway drug for a listener who might want to introduce himself to this author?
I would go with Senselessness as the first one. Either that or The Dream of My Return. That may be the easier one to get. It just came out. But I think, you know, if you read him, you'll think he has something, and he captures some feeling of being in exile or like cut off from your world that is both quite specific to him and at the same time something that kind of uneasiness, I think, that we would all feel.
John Powers, thanks for coming by to tell us about Horacio Castellanos Moya. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Boris Draliuk. Thanks to Nina Ravor, John Powers. Our thanks to Jerry Stahl. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. Our production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano. The indefatigable Sid Biggs, who came in even though he had a cold this week. We billboarded BJ Novak at the beginning of the show, and I want to apologize for his not being...
I'm sorry.
For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, I'm Seth Greenland. You've been listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. See you next week.